Coming up, you've heard of flash mobs. Kim Lawton looks at a new variation, mass mobs, encouraging Catholics to visit struggling urban churches. And Lucky Severson reports on artificial intelligence. Could robots become smarter than humans? If they did, could they then become our masters?
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. A possible nuclear deal with Iran was high on the agenda as Secretary of State John Kerry and leaders from the top industrial nations met in Germany. U.S. religious groups continue issuing reactions to the tentative agreement hammered out earlier this month. The U.S. Catholic bishops this week welcomed the agreement as a step toward peace and urged Congress not to undermine negotiations. But other faith groups have been raising concerns. Jewish leaders from a variety of political perspectives questioned whether the potential deal would ensure that Iran does not obtain nuclear weapons. The Vatican has unexpectedly ended its nearly seven-year-long investigation and oversight of U.S. nuns. On Thursday, Pope Francis met with representatives of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, the largest umbrella group of American sisters. His doctrinal office announced the church's goals had been accomplished. The oversight process was started under Pope Benedict after some church officials accused the nuns of promoting views that were incompatible with Catholic teachings. That provoked strong debate and anger around the world. This week, the Vatican said it is now confident that the mission of the nuns is, quote, rooted in the tradition of the church. Francis set off an international diplomatic furor last Sunday for explicitly using the word genocide to describe the Ottoman-era massacre of Armenian Christians. He made his remarks at a special service with Armenian church leaders to mark the 100th anniversary of the mass killings. Many countries, including the U.S., have avoided using the word genocide so they won't offend Turkey. And indeed, Turkish officials were incensed with the Pope's comments, accusing him of inciting hate. Francis has influenced Catholics in many ways, including encouraging them to use social media for church outreach. We have a Kim Lawton story this week about one project that tries to do just that. You may have heard of flash mobs, the social media-driven stunts to get a large group of people to show up at a particular place all at once. A growing movement across the U.S. is adapting that idea to encourage Catholics to visit often struggling urban churches. It's called mass mobs.
This is Blessed Trinity Roman Catholic Church in Buffalo, New York. Built for German and Irish immigrants in the 1920s, it was once the vibrant center of its working-class neighborhood. These days, on an average Sunday, only about 100 people attend morning Mass. But today, Blessed Trinity was mass-mobbed. Almost 650 people showed up. The church mass-mob movement began in Buffalo, inspired by the cultural fad of so-called flash mobs, where groups of people organized through social media show up at public places for seemingly spontaneous displays. Lay Catholic Christopher Bird is a co-founder of Buffalo Mass Mob. He says as he watched variations of flash mobs, he realized the idea could be used to help churches in his city.
We have these glorious old historic churches that sit inside of the city and a lot of our immigrant neighborhoods. They've kind of fallen off the radar screen over the years, and the idea to bring a large group of people here, it raises awareness. These churches that we attend get a lot of publicity leading up to the mass mobs, and it fills the church.
Since late 2013, Buffalo Mass Mob selects a local church, and through Twitter, Facebook, and websites, the group urges people to come to worship at that church on a specific Sunday. They've also started special fundraising projects for the selected church, such as a T-shirt sale for Blessed Trinity. Mass Mob co-founder Danielle Huber says it's a welcome shot in the arm for these often struggling congregations.
It fills the pews, it fills the coffers, it energizes the people who run the church. It energizes people that didn't know this church existed.
The movement is now spreading to a wide variety of communities across the country. In Detroit, Archbishop Alan Vigneron has encouraged people to participate.
What a wonderful idea to visit these historic churches, to experience their beauty as a way to be renewed in your faith.
But in other areas, church officials have viewed mass mobs with skepticism, and some observers wonder about the movement's long-term impact.
I think the flash mob is a great thing. I think it's good for the church. It's good for evangelization, but it's not a long-term solution. This is not going to change the landscape of parishes in the United States.
In many older American cities, especially in the Rust Belt, 19th century European immigrants settled in ethnically oriented neighborhoods. Churches like Polish St. Casimir's in Buffalo dominated local Catholic life.
The church was the hub of all the activity in this community. So everything somehow was connected with the church or the school. And the church, school, and family formed a traditional American Catholic triangle.
As immigrants prospered, they built increasingly grander churches, often modeled on the ones back in their homelands.
They were wonderful, and people sacrificed significantly to build these edifices that are magnificent, testimonies to their faith and to God.
Chester Gillis is professor of theology at Georgetown University. He says as urban neighborhoods started to deteriorate, these local churches fell on hard times as well.
The flight to the suburbs, starting in the 60s and continuing to this day, has just decimated these neighborhoods. And they're no longer what they were. And those who are left behind are often those who are poor. Many of them are not of the same religious persuasions as their predecessors. And so there's not a sustainable model for these churches.
Dioceses, including Buffalo, have been forced to close or consolidate parishes, a trend many mass mobbers would love to forestall. Ted Knizek has been to almost every Buffalo mass mob.
This is something we got to leave for future generations, these beautiful churches. Or they'll deteriorate and you'll never see them again.
Blessed Trinity is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. It's called the purest replication of 12th century Lombard Romanesque architecture in the U.S. Margaret Dick has been a member of the parish since she was a child in the 1950s, when Mass was often standing room only. She says Blessed Trinity has shaped her entire life.
To remember your first communion and how special that was, and when we were in high school, we had a CYO, Catholic Youth Organization, and you did all kinds of things together with the other teens, and it's a real bond.
But in a changing neighborhood, the church no longer plays the role it used to. With fewer regular attenders, it's difficult to maintain the huge structure.
It's very challenging, especially with a winter like we just endured here, because now is the time when you start to see where there's roof, and you can't never really tell where the roof leak is, because the water runs to the lowest place. So where you see the damage is not necessarily where the roof leak is. So it's a constant battle.
As a choir member, Dick says it was wonderful to look down during the mass mob and see her church again filled, even if just for one Sunday.
I don't think any parish thinks you're going to gain a tremendous number of new parishioners or something through this, but it's the idea that people in the community get to value something that they weren't familiar with before and realize what we have that's so worth preserving.
Gillis acknowledges a strength of the mass mobs is reminding Catholics about their heritage.
You get to see beautiful churches and you get to see a sense of the history and the richness and the culture and the art to which the church has contributed significantly in American culture. There's no question about that.
But he cautions that nostalgia is not a strategy for the future.
It's not like the church is dissolved. The church is vibrant in many, many places. It's just not in the inner city places, per se. And to say that I wish it were that way, it's wishful thinking, but it isn't that way. It's like saying, I used to love getting my newspaper and having my coffee. Well, now I have my iPad and a latte.
Many Catholics who've been involved in mass mobs say the movement's impact has been greater than people realize. St. Casimir's Church, which averages about 100 people on Sunday mornings, had almost 700 come to a mass mob in January of this year. $4,000 more than usual was collected in the offering. Father Czeslaw Kryso says they've benefited in other ways, too.
We have had people that since then have signed up, about 12 families, okay, that have signed up, said they were looking for a church. Every single Sunday since mass mob, we've had a significant number of new people or repeats. We've had people now who have volunteered for some of our fundraisers, for some of our liturgical celebrations.
He says the mass mob has provided support for the church's new mission to be a center of outreach in a community where most people don't attend St. Casimir's or any other church. But he believes the most important impact of mass mobs is spiritual.
I call this grassroots evangelization from the church point of view. This is a form of outreach, spiritual outreach, to the people. Otherwise, they wouldn't be responding.
Organizers of the mass mob movement say their own faith has been revitalized.
I wasn't coming to church every Sunday, and being part of this has not only brought me back to church, it has inspired me and re-energized myself. So my objective for everyone else has actually been for myself as well. It's astonishing.
You know, we bring people together and show, you know, it's okay, we can celebrate our faith. We can come together and celebrate our faith, and it's a wonderful thing.
And they believe, despite the many challenges facing urban churches, strength in faith will carry Catholics into the future. I'm Kim Lawton in Buffalo.
In other news, in the wake of several fatal shootings of black men, religious groups are keeping up pressure for police reforms. People of faith have been part of protests against police violence. Many congregations have been sponsoring discussions about race and law enforcement. At this week's annual conference of the Gospel Coalition, evangelicals discussed how pastors can become ministers of reconciliation by building better relationships with police and local neighborhoods. This week marked 1 year since more than 200 schoolgirls in Nigeria were abducted by the terrorist group Boko Haram. The anniversary was observed in many countries. Here in the U.S., New York's Empire State Building was lit up in red and purple in the girls' honor. In Nigeria, there were prayer services and rallies. Nigerian leaders admitted they still do not know where the girls are. Thursday was Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. In Israel, the day was observed with the traditional two-minute standstill. Meanwhile, a new report from Tel Aviv University says the number of violent anti-Semitic attacks around the world rose 40% last year. The report identified several reasons for the spike, including opposition to Israeli policies in Gaza and the anti-Israel views promoted by ISIS. ISIS released a new video this week bragging about its demolition of the ancient Assyrian city of Nimrod in Iraq. Historians believe the city was named after one of Noah's descendants. There was international condemnation after reports last month about the destruction of statues and buildings in Nimrod. On the new video, a voice in Arabic says, God has honored us to remove all of these idols.
The Lord be with you.
Cardinal Francis George, the retired Archbishop of Chicago, has died at the age of 78 after a long battle with cancer. George played a key role helping the U.S. bishops address the clergy sex abuse scandal. He was known for his intellect and perseverance. We have a provocative story today about artificial intelligence, creating software and machines that could be smarter than humans. Does that mean robots could become the masters of humans? What would determine their moral code? And should their further development be controlled? Lucky Severson looked for answers.
The core of my writing is not art, but truth. Thus, what I tell is the truth.
This is the late, great Philip K. Dick, the science fiction writer who wrote so much about androids. Actually, it is an android. But this is 2010 technology. Artificial intelligence today is vastly more sophisticated. Max Tegmark is a physicist at MIT.
One thing is certain, and that is that the reason that we humans have more power on this planet than tigers is not because we have sharper claws than tigers or stronger muscles. It's because we're smarter. So if we create machines that are smarter than us, there's absolutely no guarantee that we're going to stay in control.
And that's why Professor Tegmark and some of the world's top scientists, including Stephen Hawking, are warning that, quote, the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race.
If we can ever build a machine that's better than us humans at all cognitive tasks, then it's also going to be better than us at making artificially intelligent machines, because that's a cognitive task too. So it can very rapidly figure out how to reprogram itself to get even smarter. That leaves the possibility that after a rather short amount of time, it might not be just a little bit smarter than us, but vastly smarter than us, much like we are vastly smarter than a snail.
Tegmark says it's now possible that within this century, artificial intelligence will surpass human intelligence, an event called singularity, a term made famous by the futurist Ray Kurzweil. The worry is that if mankind is not very careful, this runaway technology could rule or perhaps ruin the world. Wanda Wallach is a scholar at the Yale Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics.
If the technological singularity is truly possible, that will be one of the greatest crises that humanity could confront, particularly in terms of whether we can manage or control that and exact benefits from it rather than being, what shall I say, turned into the house pets of superior beings.
I remember when I was a kid and they came out with the most powerful computer ever, the new Cray supercomputer. Well, I have a computer in my lab which is more powerful than that now. My phone.
Computers have come so far, so fast. In Japan, President Obama played soccer with an android.
Hey, good job.
And baby androids can be programmed to mimic a real baby. But the idea of robots isn't new. What's new is the intelligence itself.
I'm Asimov, a humanoid robot. It is a pleasure to meet you.
And science is trying to determine if artificial intelligence can be instilled with consciousness.
Consciousness is one of the faculties that used to be talked about as a gift of the soul. Consciousness and moral acumen and intelligence, all these things that we are now looking for ways to perhaps reproduce within computational systems. And we have theories about how we may proceed. There are scientific ideas about what consciousness is, what moral acumen is, what all these different capabilities are. But those experiments are still at a very early stage.
Wallach does not believe singularity is as near as some scientists claim, but he doesn't discount it. He's a co-author of a book called Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right from Wrong.
I'm one of those people who's really fascinated about what we can actually imbue into artificial intelligence. Which of our capabilities, which of our capacities can we actually imbue in them? And what we learn about human nature or how we humans function in the process of trying. I think we've learned that the moral decision making is much more complex than we even thought it to be.
We've been challenged over and over again with what humanity can do with technology.
Paul Schurz is a professor of moral theology and ethics at Catholic University and the skeptic that humans can pass along morality to machines.
Where do we gain our sense of morality? We gain our sense of morality through community, through those around us, through our relationships. They're the ones who teach us how to be good people.
Another skeptic, Professor Jared Mannion, the amatorial professor of Catholic Studies at Georgetown University.
For it to be morality, they'd have to have free will, and they'd have to have every facet of consciousness that human beings have. That doesn't seem to be on the cards just yet. And if you could program a machine with morality, it would be a selective form of morality coming from the programmers.
So when you're talking about programming morality, yes, whose morality, what morality? Do we even want machines making moral decisions? Do you want them to put them in morally significant situations so they have to make decisions? And even if we agree what the decisions are, can we be sure that the machine will make the appropriate decision?
Professor Tedmark says there is no law in physics that says man cannot program morality into artificial intelligence.
I think it should absolutely be possible to make machines which have morality in the same way that we do. If you think about me as a big connection of quarks and electrons that compute, take information in, figure out what to do, and then do it, there are certain computational circuits in me that embody my morality, my empathy and compassion for other people, my knowing right from wrong. And just like we can teach this to our children, we should be able to teach it to machines. So it's, yes, it's doable, but do we know how to do it now? Not so much.
So if man can instill morality into a machine, what about a soul, which has been described as the immortal essence of a living thing?
You could do an awful lot that would make it appear as if it has a soul. And, you know, we already have certain robots and so on that seem to be able to mimic and replicate a great deal of what you would attribute to a human character. Anyone who has an iPhone, you know, will talk to Siri on a daily basis and marvel at her intelligence.
Siri, do you have a soul?
I've never really thought about it.
It's the technology of the present that worries Yale's Wendell Wallach. Drones, self-driving automobiles, our ability to spy on one another. His new book is called A Dangerous Master, How to Keep Technology from Slipping Beyond Our Control.
I think that it's accelerating in a way where our oversight is very poor and we aren't attending to the risks. So we are in danger of letting the risks overwhelm the benefits and losing control of technological development.
There's certainly already an increasing spread of artificial intelligence into our daily lives, and that is of concern. I mean, you could say in some ways, you know, there's a form of singularity that's already long past. We've taken the eye off the ball for how much technology is taking over in our societies.
Professor Tedmark heads the Future of Life Institute in Cambridge, which has a goal of making the most of artificial intelligence for the good of mankind.
Artificial intelligence is the ultimate powerful technology, because if we ever succeed in making machines that are much smarter than us and can keep amplifying their own intelligence, there's basically no limit to how much we can figure out with our help. There's almost no limit to how awesome life can become, flourishing in the cosmos. But there's also almost no limit on the extent to which we could mess up.
We need to encourage more ethical literacy across the board and ethical discernment at each stage of scientific and technological development. We need to ask, hang on, before we allow a license for this technology to be rolled out and put out there, we need to say, has due diligence been done on the ethical and social and legal implications of this?
For any technology, there's always a race between the power of the technology on one hand and the wisdom with which we manage the technology on the other hand. And you always need to have the wisdom win this race.
It's the wisdom and how to apply it that Max Tedmark and other physicists are working on. Regulations, if there are to be any, are down the road. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
On our calendar for Baha'is, sundown April 20th marks the beginning of the 12-day festival of Ridvan. It celebrates the days the founder of their faith, Baha'u'llah, spent in the Iraqi garden of Ridvan in 1863. During that time, he declared himself to be the promised one of all religions. Finally, at the White House this week, a celebration of gospel music.
My, what a house.
The Obamas hosted many prominent musicians for a special concert. The president praised the role of gospel music in America.
Gospel music has evolved over time, but its heart stays true. It still has an unmatched power to strike the deepest chord in all of us, touching people of all faiths and of no faith.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more gospel music from Pastor Shirley Caesar. The full concert, called In Performance at the White House, will air on PBS June 26th.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.